This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Matt, Connell, here we are, Perspectives. I don't know what episode we're up to, but man, we've just had...
The reason why we're laughing, Stu,
we
just had a pre-podcast conversation. We should have pressed the... No. which consisted mainly in questions, yeah, which was right. Great. I thought it's the perfect setup for this discussion that we're going to have. So introduce us, Stu. You do all the nice stuff and then we'll jump in.
And you'll do all the nasty stuff, right? Well, Connell, welcome back into the studio. Thanks for the coffees.
That's right.
Connell is our coffee man. He delivers a great coffee every time we sit in a...
Doesn't make it.
But cold studio. No, he doesn't make it. No, we don't have a coffee machine in here, Matt. Come on. And Matt, of course, we know who has read all the books that exist in the world.
I can't
keep up with a list of them. But anyway, welcome, listeners. It's great to have you back with us. We are going to be looking at the human predicament, as we would say, as we look at evil, we look at suffering, we look at those things in the world, and we try to understand how that sits in our worldview. Where do you want to start, Matt?
Well, this brings us to, I guess, the element of the... In a sense, we're entering into the story now. We've previously... we've discussed probably what is more of a kind of biblical philosophical framework. You know, that we've talked about those dimensions of reality, and I know that's sounds a little esoteric, but you know, we've done our best to sort of illustrate that because of the way that our culture sort of flattened reality out, has a very flat view of reality. But actually now we want to enter something more dynamic, because this is another very important aspect of the biblical worldview, is that it's a moving story, and this... With a lot of questions that come up, particularly questions about evil that vex a lot of people, a lot of those questions cannot really be adequately answered unless we understand the story. It's a little bit like it almost, for me, in thinking about these sorts of questions, was a bit like a bit of a Copernican revolution. Now, you know, up until the time of Copernicus, you know, they couldn't. The calculations in terms of the orbital path of the planets just never made sense. They couldn't, you know, the sums just never quite added up. And then they realized, and this is the Copernican revolution. You know, Copernicus's discovery was that, well, actually, but the Earth, the point from which we are observing the stars, is a moving point. You know, the Earth is actually rotating on its axes.
Yes.
And actually the Earth itself is in orbit around the sun, right? Mm. And so, you know, that perspective and the movement of the Earth, that had to be taken into consideration, because we're not observing the planets from a static point of view. We're actually a moving object. So I think this is a little similar to what an understanding of the movement of the biblical narrative offers us in terms of some of these questions, because we're actually moving somewhere. We're not just in a static ideal. We know we're not. If you look at the world, we're not in a static ideal circumstance. It's the idea of history that we now have. Sort of begins with scripture, begins with this idea of linear history. Mm. Most ancient peoples thought about history in a cyclical sense. Right, yeah. In fact, lots of the other cultures that tend to do that as well, although now with the universal dating system and everything like that, now we do all tend to see history as linear. But that wasn't always the case. And the idea of linear history, it comes from this idea that there's an overarching story, or what you would refer to as a meta-narrative. Mm-hmm. So we're in the midst of a story and it's moving somewhere. It's moving towards a goal. Now, that story got sort of hijacked in the Enlightenment and it became a story of humanistic progress. So the biblical story sort of got hijacked, mm-hmm. you know, and as I said, yeah, it became the story of progress. So, and in fact, that's a story. A lot of people don't probably think about the story that they think that they're in, but everyone in our culture, they actually do believe they're in the midst of a story, and most people even sort of implicitly believe we're in a story of essentially humanistic progress. Now, that story has been, in the last, 30 or so years, has been skewed a bit with the story, particularly with facing things like climate change, and because now it's undermined the story of humanistic progress. That's something that we can talk about down the track a bit. But that's a sort of healthy development, because there was always this sense
it's getting
better. It's getting better. And we're gonna be more civilized and more humane and more and in a sense there are a number of things that have gotten better. So the famous expression of this most recent expression is the philosopher Steven Pinker wrote a book called Enlightenment Now, and he argues for the principles of the Enlightenment, rule of reason. He's a classic humanist, atheistic humanist. And we are going to solve all our own problems, and it's been getting better, and it's going to keep getting better, right? We'll come, even with climate change, we'll come up with a solution for all of these things, right? And, people love to believe that sort of stuff because, well, what else is there? It's difficult to face a future in a completely pessimistic way. Well, there is another story, and what we want to do here is actually to remind our listeners of that big overarching story, and this is not just going to be a sort of basic tell the story of the Bible. I do want to underscore some of the real implications for our worldview of the key elements of this story, and particularly to understanding our human predicament now and what the future of that is.
So, just before you go into that, I just want to underline how important I think that is, that narrative, the story that sits behind it, because so often in terms of the problem of evil, it's probably most out there in the apologetics land would frame up the problem of evil as perhaps the biggest dilemma facing Christians. And I think atheists see it as almost like the ticket to win every argument, because we view everything through more of a static view from our own rationality of being able to kind of reason. Ultimately, I guess from a human perspective as well, if I see evil in the world, I feel I'm obligated to try to fix it or do something about it. And then, we transfer that then to, well, what should God do? God should fix up all the evil in the world. And if I just ignore evil, if I walk down the street and someone's lying there on the ground in pain and suffering, and I could actually step in and do something to fix that situation, for me to walk on by and just ignore it would actually make me evil because of that particular point in time and making that decision. If we transfer that to God, you could certainly argue that that's what God all the time. He sees incredible evil and suffering all throughout history, and yet God seemingly just goes, well, and there's all these philosophical arguments and apologetics arguments offered up to try to explain why God would behave that way. But ultimately, you can kind of see how atheists or even, Christians would struggle with it as well and arrive at the conclusion and say, well, it would be evil for me to behave that way. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it must be evil for God to behave that way. And I think this is where, before you get into the story, just to really underline it, because I think this is the key to understand that. You can't view it from our perspective. It's not a static point in time. Yeah. It's a much bigger
thing. That's right. So that it's very true. That doesn't add up. And that is the main positive argument from the side of atheists, because they can't really offer a positive argument to say God doesn't exist, in any other sense. What they have to try and show is that our theism is incoherent, is internally incoherent, right?
Yep.
And they use the problem of evil to argue this. But this is a little bit like the pre-Copernican astronomers doing the calculations and it not adding up, right? Mm-hmm. And it's because, and again, there's a sort of Copernican revolution to happen here, that to recognize actually we're not sitting at a static point, we're moving. And it's the story It's the story that is the key to understanding that. So, you know, if you're listening and you think, man, I've always wondered that, just doesn't make sense to me. What I think an understanding of the biblical story is going to do is going to essentially affect kind of Copernican revolution. It's going to help you understand this, in a really important way. Right. But it's also going to point forward to what our part and how we. I mean, this is actually really practical.
Yeah, right.
Because one of the things that there's that problem, but there's also the problem hand in hand with that is this problem that the story, the kind of modern story of our culture does seep into us as well. Mm. You know, so we feel like things should be getting better and we'll come up with the solutions and we can start thinking like that as well. We can really buy into that story. And when it doesn't work out or when there isn't the progress that we would expect from that sort of enculturation, then we start shaking our fist at God. Mm. But that's a different story. And this is one of the key problems is that we live in the wrong story. I can't overstate how important this is, but also this is, in my experience, in my discussions with people from church, even students, theological students, actually the problem of living in the wrong story is quite a pervasive problem. And so...
And really, Matt, just what you're saying there, when we live in the wrong story, what we're saying is that's your perspective. You know, that's exactly what we're trying to talk about here. That's your worldview. That's the story. When we use the term story, we're talking about the worldview in which you look at everything. You know?
Yeah. So we have to go back. And in a sense, in Genesis chapters 1 to 3 are the real kind of worldview chapters of the Bible. And the thing that chapter 1 emphasizes is perfect order. And I'm going to do really broad brushstrokes here, is this idea of perfect order. I mean, you know, Genesis 1 expresses that not only in the content, in the sense that, you know, you've got these actions, you've got these actions of separating and naming and, you know, God brings things into being by his word. So he calls things into being. So there's this sense of absolute authority. It's the direct expression of God's will that these things are. But it's not just that they are, it's the fact that they are then ordered in a certain way. It's the ordering of those things, right? At the end of each day, you know, God saw that it was good. You get that statement repeated seven times. Now, numbers are very important in Genesis, Genesis 1. But the goodness is in the order. In the order of things. So you get these actions of separating, naming, the repetition of line according to their kinds, according to their kinds, according to their kinds, right? So everything it expresses order. Now, that's because the first, you know, verse, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty, and it talks about the Spirit of God hovering over the surface of the deep, the waters, the watery. And in ancient Near Eastern, it's appealing to an ancient Near Eastern idea of a sort of primeval chaos, like an original chaotic sort of situation. And it's not necessarily buying into that. It's essentially showing, because it's not evil, but it's formless and without void. It's unfinished. So we have an insight into a process here, but there's a theological, the way that this process is expressed has enormous theological significance, because what we see God doing is speaking into a situation as formless and void and filling it with goodness, and that goodness is characterized by order. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's in the content. So and it's, you know, you get that not only with the content but also the form of the text. And this is something that's been underappreciated in all these ridiculous debates over whether the Bible and science, you know, Bible and science and all of that. I say ridiculous debates because often they overlook, I think, the art of the text, if I can speak that way. Often people get nervous about that because they think if there's art, an art to the art can't be right or can't be true. Mm-hmm. But no, it's true, but it's expressed
in a certain way.
Something very mysterious, something that's beyond anything that we can conceive ultimately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not trying to do cosmology as such. This is incredibly theological. It's this elevated prose that expresses something not only in the content but, as I said, in the form, right? So you get 10 times it says, and God said 10 times. Now, you know, think of the Ten Commandments. You know, it's like God says ten, you know, and then God saw that it was good seven times. Seven is the number of perfection. God creates and God makes. There are two different words that are used. They are used five times each to equal ten. I could go on, right? You know, things created according to their kinds. I think that's seven times that one as well. So there's this incredible symmetry to this to this text. It's Genesis 1 is one of the most, to me, it's staggering in how amazing this text is in terms of how it's put together. But it's this idea of perfect order. Now, this is important because, and we've flagged this idea before, that the nature of evil, because the question is asked, how does evil exist? If God created everything in the universe, hasn't God then essentially created evil, right? This is one of the problems. It's like a logical problem that they bring forth. But if once you understand things in terms of that idea of order, God bringing perfect order, and this was Augustine's insight to essentially defining evil. He defined it as a disordering. So the things that everything is good, but those good things can be disordered, right?
And we've talked about this in other episodes.
That's
when we're talking about the axis, you know, like from the sacred to the profane. Is like, how can the profane exist when there's, you know, did God create profanity and all that? And but and also the idea of order as well. Ultimately, sacredness. Order is kind of established in that, in terms of what God declared.
Yeah, was perfect harmony, and that's right.
It's and as you say, like right from the beginning, you know, you could get into all the scientific, which is Genesis trying to describe a scientific process and cosmology. Yeah. I just don't think we can ever answer those questions satisfactorily. But the key point of Genesis is the order.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't want to miss the ordering, because the ordering, as we've talked about in all the other episodes we've done on this, ties back into almost understanding what is sacred and what isn't sacred.
That's right.
The separation of, you know, this is sacred and this is not sacred, which ultimately leads to the profane, which is when you kind of desecrate what, which, or I guess another way of saying that is creating the disorder.
Yeah. And so you've essentially got, I mean, the way that Augustine describes it is like a hierarchy of goods. You know, it's part of this order. You know, and I think that's a really important insight, because of course this is the first, you know, we're talking about the first three chapters of the Pentateuch, or the Torah, the five books of the first five books of the Bible, which are all about establishing an order for the life of God's people. It's bringing God's order back to the life of the people. That's what Torah is essentially all about. Okay. And so you got this, you know, your first chapter, and with those five books, there's an amazing order to that as well. And I could talk about, some of the literary structure about that, but that's beside the point now. So what essentially happens in Genesis chapter 3 is that order gets flipped upside down. This is the significance of where you get essentially the serpent, that is the lowest of all the creatures, in a sense, thinking about this hierarchy, right? Mm. And because, again, you know, we think of hierarchy as a bad, you know, we think of tyranny and all of that. But again, it's so difficult for us to think about these ideas in a perfect world, because they've all been
corrupted.
Everything's been corrupted, right? Yeah. So even using this sort of language is difficult, because its associations are always with the corrupt forms of those things. Okay, but in God's economy, there's this hierarchy, right? Human beings were created children of God. Then this is a very important part of this. Human beings are created children of God. They are put in charge, in a sense. They're bearing God's image. I mean, you know, we're like, and this is an illustration that Jesus uses, you know, we're like branches out of the vine, we grow out of God in this sense. We are, our very identity is our connection with God in this very intimate way. So to be created in God's image is another way of saying we are God's children. Mm-hmm. and we bear his glory and his, you know, it's a beautiful image there. But the important thing is that we're put in charge. So human beings, in a sense, are responsible for maintaining this order. We are part of the order, but we're also the keystone species, in to use a sort of ecological term, right? Yeah. We are a keystone species. Now, a keystone species is, in ecology, is one upon which everything else is quite dependent. You know, so if the key, and the keystone is this idea in an arch, you know, there's that triangular-shaped stone at the top of an arch that holds everything else in place. So if you pull the keystone out, everything else falls in a pile. Mm. And so what you see there is essentially human beings are this keystone species. We are there to keep the harmony and to be stewards of God's order. So God says to humanity, fill the earth and subdue it. And subduing, again, there's another word that we think through a sort of corrupted lens, because that means exploit, right?
Like oppression.
Yeah, but it does not mean exploitation, right?
Yeah.
And lots of, you know, ecologists say, oh, well, you know, the sort of license to exploit the world comes from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And again, it's no, it's the exact opposite, right? Because subduing the earth does not mean exploit. It is defined by its context, and the context is Genesis chapter 1, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about order. Subdue. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what God does, is that he subdues the chaos. That's the very definition of that word is given in the context of chapter 1. Because remember, we are created in God's image. We are to be in his likeness, and we're to do like God does, right?
And I guess it's like with ourselves, we need to become the image that God created us to be.
Yeah.
And in the same way, there's an order, there's natural order in how things are created.
Yeah.
Subduing the earth in creation is about giving it the potential to become
it was created.
The identity that God, where it sits, its place.
Yeah, that's
its order, so that it becomes what God wanted it be.
As opposed to exploiting it.
Yes, correct. For our benefit.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're growing it for to be what God wanted it to be, not what we wanted it to be.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, this is a really important idea, that idea of subduing the earth is about that, very much about that order. It's you know, we reflect God's likeness as we do like God does, and the subduing the earth and maintaining that order in our lives and in our environment is a very, very important part of that. The empowerment is another very important principle. Now, this is probably the key thing to understanding what goes wrong, the nature of what goes wrong. And so this needs to be emphasized. We were empowered. Now, it says in Romans 11:29, the gifts and call of God are irrevocable, right? God is an empowering God. He empowered human beings in his likeness to rule over the world. Now, we're created in his likeness, so we have these personal capacities. We have the capacity for choice and for relationship. Remember, we were created to be God's children. And so in order to be able to genuinely have relationships, that's why God doesn't just create robots. We're not just biological organisms that automatically do certain things. The highest and most valued thing in all of Scripture, as you see, is the ability to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, in order to love, you actually need to make a choice. There has to be an element of freedom, of choice there. So, on the one hand, we are created with this freedom of choice because we're created for relationship. On the other hand, we're given, you know, this authority over this realm. The world, in a sense, is given to human beings for us to rule over. It's our home, and we're put in charge. So, in a sense, we are the prince, to use a biblical term. We are the princes of this world. I don't get rid of the gender associations of that word. The reason why I use this word is because, do you recall, Jesus talks about the prince of this world?
Yeah.
Who is he talking about?
Sorry, Satan.
He's talking about Satan. Mm-hmm. But hang on a minute. how did he become the prince of the world? because at that actually in Genesis 1, that's us. Like we are, you know, God is the king, but we are the princes of this world, right? We're in charge of the world. So there's that's a hint of what's coming up in the story, in a sense, to sort of flag that. So the authority is really important. Because let's just think through the implications of this authority. Authority means that what we choose happens. And remember, God is committed now to our empowerment. And even if we get it wrong, as it says in Romans 11:29, the gifts of God, gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. It means he doesn't take it back, right? Mm-hmm. God doesn't disempower. Mm-hmm. So empowerment means that, like, if I empower you to do something, well, and you make a mess of it, well, you're in charge. You need to, it's up to you really to clean it up or to, you know, like I'm not going to then step in and say, oh, let me take, I push you aside.
Well, that's not empowerment.
That's not empowerment, yep. Right?
Yep. It's taking it off you again.
Now, I mean, don't try not to jump forward into the story too much, but that is a very, very important idea because essentially God is committed, absolutely committed himself to allowing whatever consequences we choose, because we're in charge, right? And we're going to make choices. God is committing himself to letting consequences flow from our choices.
Well, we need to feel the consequences. Imagine if God stepped
fixed everything and patched.
We wouldn't even, I mean, what value? Where would we put sin? Like, would we even care about sin anymore? We wouldn't even have any concept of sin because with every choice, it just gets fixed up.
Yeah, that's right.
Where you go back to the Old Testament, how they treated sin. I mean, if we handled that the same way today, we'd be bringing animals down into the auditorium here, into the church, and slaughtering them up on the. Imagine applying that to a modern context, you know. And we have lost. It's so easy to lose the severity and consequences of sin.
Yeah.
So I think no matter how much suffering and evil, when we give up that responsibility that we have and the consequences flow from it, no matter how bad, God still allows that.
Well, he does, but here's the key thing. Mm-hmm. He is doing something about it, but he's doing something about it in such a way as to not compromise his original commitment. Because remember, he's committed himself to empowering human beings, right? Yeah. So God is not just going to then undercut that authority. Mm-hmm. You know, if he is to do something, either human beings need to fix up their mess, but actually that becomes in a way impossible because the mess just becomes so irreversible. So then you got, so it's almost like by God's commitment, only human beings, he's committed to that being a human prerogative.
Yeah.
This realm. Mm-hmm. So human beings are the ones, it's for them to fix it up, and yet it's impossible for them to fix up. This is the dilemma of the text. So essentially, if it's going to be fixed up, like only God can do it, but God would have to become human in order to do it. Not that would God ever do such a thing. Well, that's where I'm skipping ahead.
You're getting too far ahead.
Story.
Yeah, too far ahead.
I'm skipping
it's
ahead.
A spoiler alert.
Yeah. You know, as you know, Paul says, as in Adam all died, so in Christ, you know, as in one man, and then, you know, this is the first man and the first and second Adam. I mean, this all of this theology that we see in the New Testament has this narrative framework, right? It's a narrative framework. We can think too abstractly about this theology, but Paul is always referring to the story. And he's saying, this is why only Jesus could do this, the one who was fully God and fully human. There's a really good reason why it had to be Jesus and why it can only be him. Mm. So, but that's giving away the end of the story.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us. And,
anyway, but here's the, so that principle of empowerment is really important as we go on to think about the human predicament, right?
Okay. Yeah, because this kind of answers the question to some degree, and we've got a bit more to do to answer it. C.S. Lewis, I think, phrased it well. I've got it written down here because I knew I'd misquote him, but he puts this argument, if God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy, and if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished, but the creatures are not happy, therefore God lacks either goodness or power or both, you know, and this is the argument that
Yeah,
people say, if God is an all-loving God and an almighty God, and
he's articulating the argument against theism there. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And of course, he's a Christian, so
yes,
and he's going to think very much in terms of the story.
That's right.
Because if you just put it in a static logical form, it's like, yeah, that doesn't all fit together. But if you know, again, this is the Copernican thing. Mm-hmm. If you consider that, no, but it's not static. Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, we're moving here, mm-hmm. and it's moving somewhere. Then that is going to help us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just before you move on, I reckon what we're getting to, and I know we're getting to it later, but you know, you often hear people saying, "Oh, I can deal with the God thing," but the whole Jesus thing, it's like,
yeah,
that
exactly.
really speaks yeah. strongly to yeah. that mm. to that particular yeah. perspective and that people come.
I think too that the if I was God, then I would have intervened. If I saw evil, and this goes back to what I said yeah. at the start, we look at, and this is the danger of looking at it from our perspective, from our static reference point, is that if I was God, I wouldn't walk past the person who's suffering. I would try to intervene and fix this situation up. But God solves the problem. He doesn't want to take away our empowerment. He wants us to remain empowered. He wants us to feel the impact of our decisions and choices, no matter how yeah. horrific, but he still has to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And this is where, this is, you know, that's...
Yeah, and the other problem, and this goes back to our former episodes, you know, because you talk about walking past a person, they're in pain, that's a bad thing, and yeah, but we're operating not just on a pleasure-pain axis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's an axis of sanctification, holiness, and so God's not just taking things on a trajectory from pain to pleasure. Mm. It's actually the vertical axis that he's interested mm-hmm. in. So that adds, you know, that means that even pain can have this in within the story, okay, can be a kind of have this elevating effect. But we're jumping,
yep.
and I'm not saying that's not an answer to it, because in the story, actually, one of the beauty things that's beautiful about the story is that, you know, we don't have to find reasons for things. Like, it's, I shouldn't say it's a beautiful thing about it. So it's just what the story provides is the ability to validate the fact that it's just bad, right? It's yeah. just bad. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, something's happening in the world. And I think what you say about the importance of Jesus in all of this is just so significant, because we can only really understand Jesus in the story, right? Mm. You know, and that's the attitude that often people have, is like, well, what, you know, why can't we just believe in God and all the Jesus stuff and dying on a cross for our sins? And, you know, that I mean, atheists love just paying out on that, like, mm-hmm. oh, that's just mm-hmm. so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that God would come and die on it. Well, yes, in that pure abstract sense, but actually in the story, mm-hmm. it is the fulfillment. It's the perfect fulfillment mm-hmm. of the story, right? And so yeah. if you're in the story, it makes sense. Jesus, you know, comes as the culmination of the story. That's important for understanding Jesus. Mm. But let's go back to yep. let's go back to the beginning of the story, because what we have in Genesis chapter 3 is an inversion of that order. So we've talked about order, and this is expressed very purposefully in the text, in the way that we have the lowest of all creatures, as I began to say before. We have the lowest of all creatures essentially taking authority over the highest of all the creatures. So you get this flipping up of everything. Now, the context for that is the two trees, and the two trees essentially has this, it relates to that, the aspect of humanity, of this idea of them having a choice, being given a choice. Now, even now we have, God uses physical mechanisms to externalize and make very clear a choice. So we have baptism and communion in the Old Testament. They had sacrifice. The whole temple system was physical objects that we used to they sort of have this sacramental significance in the sense of they become choice-making mechanisms, mm-hmm. you know. by doing those physical things, those physical objects became ways of declaring a choice, essentially. You know, same with when we take communion in the bread and the cup. It's a way of physical signification of a choice. Now, the two trees in Genesis chapter 2 have this kind of role, right? There's the tree of life, eternal life. This is what God wants for us. But then there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Why a tree of knowledge of good and evil? Well, there's this original innocence in humanity that we're so inside the perfect order that there's no sense of that there's anything else, right? But God knows that there is a possibility of something else, but we don't yet, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the knowledge of good and evil is essentially us stepping outside of that imminent, you know, that being inside that goodness, inside that perfect order. It's almost like an attempt to step outside of that and be like God, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what's brought out in the text, that because when Satan in the form of the serpent comes and again, it's interesting because remember the 10 times and God said and God said and God said, and yet when Satan comes, and this is the inversion of everything, did God really say that? Mm. That's the thing that he calls in. Did God really say? Mm-hmm. So that's the beginning of the inversion. It's the deception, right? Remember the first thing is let there be light, and deception is understood as a sort of kind of darkness. And so this is deception is essentially also a form of chaos. He's going to sow in chaos. I mean, the interesting thing, the background to this as well, is that the the God associated with the watery chaos in ancient Mesopotamia is this serpent god. That's associated with the sort of watery chaos. And so it's interesting that the connection of the serpent god and the watery chaos, you know, the realm of death. And so the text is drawing on familiar imagery as well and, imbuing that with this sort of extra significance. And so did God really say, and then Satan says, but God knows that when you eat of the tree of knowledge, you'll be like God. Yeah. The irony is there that they were created already in God's likeness. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially deception, a little bit like evil, is a disordering of God's hierarchy of goods. Deception is a disordering of truth. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Deception contains the truth. It's just twisted and sort of disordered truth in a way. This is why in order to be deceived, there has to be something intuitively believable about the deception. Otherwise, it's not deceiving, right? There has to be some element of truth in it, but twisted and distorted for me to get drawn into that. And this is essentially, Satan is taking something true, just twisting it a little bit, and that becomes the temptation. And so what you get then is, Adam and Eve yield to this temptation. They eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
It's interesting that was there right from the start, that there was the two trees. That it's almost like part of the design is of the way that God's built us in the world is that there's always a choice. We always have to keep making a choice.
And it's a choice between what belongs to God. This is me. This is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This is the divine prerogative. But I'm giving you eternal life, right? So eat from the tree of life, but let me be God. It's, but they have to, they step over that.
So creating that tree that kind of leads us away from God, that choice is really important in terms of how God relates
to us.
That there's always an ability, an exit door in the relationship that we can choose to walk away.
It isn't a relationship.
That's right. And that's there, communicated really strongly right from the start. It's one of the kind of key foundational pillars of how God built the world. That's fundamental into how we relate to the world and to God.
Right. And essentially, recognizing God's you know, recognizing the divine prerogative is a crucial element of worship. What we were created for worship is the other thing, the structure of Genesis 1, you know, the sort of middle point of the Genesis is the days and the seasons, which are associated for a Jewish audience with worship, right? Sacred seasons. That's right at the center. Mm-hmm. Remember, in this form of literature, whatever's in the center is the most important thing, right? Mm-hmm. So the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16 is right at the center of the Pentateuch, you know. So worship is a key idea there. We're created for worship, and worship means recognizing that recognizes the divine prerogative and doesn't try to step over, mm-hmm. you know, into that. So the temptation, you know, they've stepped over that. And essentially, by doing that, they've essentially joined whatever is going on there with Satan. And I mean, you know, we're not given much explanation about this. You almost sense they're, you know, why aren't we told more about who on earth is this serpent? Like, where did he come? What's that all about? But we've got to realize, actually, that in the ancient world, they believed in the existence of spiritual beings, evil spiritual beings. And they believed that there was this kind of struggle, kind of spiritual struggle out there. And the Bible doesn't, it corrects significant elements of that. But it validates the fact that, yes, actually there are spiritual beings out there. And it seems to assume that there's this understanding that there's this chaos in the spiritual world, but we're not given a lot of explanation. But if you put together, you know, everything that we're told, you know, in the Bible, you get this sense that there's actually a spiritual rebellion happening. Mm. And in a sense, human beings seem to be getting drawn into a spiritual rebellion. Now, I mean, you know, people like, you know, Milton, the famous poem of John Milton, Paradise Lost, tries to fill in all the gaps. He tries to tell the story of, you know, the fall of Satan from heaven. And, you know, because there are texts in the Bible that seem to allude to a fall of Satan from heaven. There seems to be a story behind this that we're not really aware of now, but we can piece it together with enough to recognize that there's some kind of fall of angels, or, you know, fallen angels, or there's some kind of spiritual rebellion that happens in the spiritual realm.
But that makes sense. We know that's how God made us in the world to have that choice and ability to rebel if we wanted to. It makes sense that will always exist, even in heaven. Otherwise, we'll always be at, otherwise we're back to the problem of we just become robots incapable of making that choice. I don't want to read because I don't think we really know how that would work, but there has to be, you would think there'd be some sort of ability to do that. Hence, we would see in the spiritual world that there's fallen angels and so on. But
that's right, because we're not the only beings with choice, and, you know, there are spiritual beings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know, the flat worldview, the flatlanders, as we've, you know, we'll say, that's a load of nonsense and spirits and all of that's, what a load of nonsense. But actually, you know, human beings have always had this sense of this. And just to, you know, to poo-poo that, like, off, I just think that's really arrogant to, because, you know, it's essentially what has happened in our times is shutting down of this other aspect of reality that human beings have always intuited. You know, even now you go to traditional cultures and there's this very real sense of a spiritual world, and it's often a bad experience. But, you know, this has always been, human beings have always sort of recognized this aspect of reality. So I think it's a bit arrogant just to shut all that out and say, it's a load of nonsense.
I think
because, and we're not talking about fairies and goblins. I know it's taken on mythological, and it did in the ancient world as well. It was given a mythological guise. But the reality behind that, I think it's really arrogant to just to dismiss the reality behind that.
It's arrogant and it's really illogical because, I think we said in an earlier episode, you know, we live in the four dimensions, but it's arrogant to think that just because we only perceive
three dimensions.
To me, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that that's it.
Yeah.
That's just because that's just what we see. I mean, I think there's even, when we look at a spirit and soul and so on, it's like that's almost like an extension of us into the fifth, sixth, seventh dimension, whatever they happen to be. It's completely incomprehensible to us. So because it's incomprehensible, we think that, oh, well, it mustn't exist. But that to me is just so arrogant and so irrational to just reject it just because I can't perceive it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's come back, though, to if I can, to the garden, you know, because I think this kind of speaks into the topic we're kind of going on quite, well, obviously significantly. You know, Adam and Eve, there was innocence, you know, they walked in the garden naked.
Mm.
Essentially, by making a choice and becoming aware of choice, in a sense, then comes accountability.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, so there is, when you're totally trusting God, so the question was really, do you trust God?
And if
you trust God, you don't need to ask those questions because it doesn't matter. But if you don't trust God,
then trust is a relational thing.
Trust is a relational thing. Then comes accountability, and that accountability is the price of the choice you make, is the cost of the choice you make. And so even you see Jesus, you know, we've been in our other podcast, been talking through John, where he says, now that you know, you're accountable because you now know.
That's right.
Similar thing going on here.
You know? Absolutely.
But it's interesting too, because that was when God made the world. I don't think how we ended up was any surprise to him, you know, how the evil that came into the world and what Jesus, the answer to that and so on. Don't want to give the ending away. But, that, you know, it was no surprise. It was always part of the plan. But it's interesting that he made the world perfect, because it was perfect then, and yet there was still the serpent was in the garden, and we were still exposed to evil.
Yeah, although we're not sure of the timeline here, and remember, if we're working with multiple dimensions, potentially, use that, whether that's the right way of speaking about it, you know, you're working potentially with a dimension that's not part of the space-time dimension. Yep. So you know, I mean, even that thing about, you know, God knew that it would all of that. That's us trying to understand
linearly,
I guess, the ways of God from within a space-time framework, and I think that's problematic. And same, you know, in terms of what is happening in the spiritual world, because this is an important feature of the text. But again, it's not, you know, it's like the serpent comes along, and in our context, we're like, what? But they're not. The readers in the ancient world aren't. That's no surprise to them. Oh, this is, you know, the serpent of chaos, and you know, something about that guy, and he's construed in different ways. But you know, they already recognize a spiritual world, like, you know, world of spiritual evil, sort of behind that. You can, you know, there's something going on in the background, and I think the fact that we're not told a lot about it. It's not that it's not relevant. It's important that we know that this is going on in the background, but we're not. It's not that we don't have interaction of it, but it's, we're only told what we need to know, in a sense. We're told what we need to know, and we need to know that this is going on in the background, and we're told how to win that spiritual battle. Mm-hmm. But I'm jumping ahead, and we'll we'll get to that. But
the only question in the garden was, do you trust God?
Essentially,
that was what was asked in this relationship, which is built on trust. Do you trust God?
Yeah,
and the answer was, well, no.
And I think that's important, because when you get to the ministry of Jesus, it comes back to that question: Are you willing to trust God? Mm-hmm. What was he always looking for? He was looking for faith. What does it say in Luke chapter 18? When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Are you willing to trust God? And that's why begins with faith. You know, it's from faith to faith, as Paul says. Mm-hmm. So, the interesting thing in Genesis 3 then is that you get this inversion. So, and this is why I refer to this spiritual rebellion, whatever's going on there, is that essentially human beings get drawn into that. So in order to tempt in that way these human beings, there already has to be this sort of rebellion. That is already a part of a rebellion, in a sense, that seems to be going on. And so, you know, I mean, you sort of conjecture that human beings have been given, and again, this is a little conjectural, so let me, but it maybe points to some of the possibilities here. If there is a heavenly rebellion, couldn't God just destroy those angels? And, you know, I mean, why doesn't he just destroy them? Now, you could argue that about human beings as well. But what happens here actually is that essentially Satan gets permission. It's like almost like human beings are sheltering a criminal in a sense. They've been given charge of this realm. You know, if I'm Satan not wanting to be destroyed, I'll get these guys to give me permission, right? To, because they're, God's really put them in charge, right? And when God empowers, that's, you know, so, and I can get permission from them by getting them to join my rebellion. So in a sense, if I can get them to, because authority and responsibility, you refer to responsibility, they're two sides of the same coin, right? Yeah. If I can get human beings to abdicate responsibility, basically I can get them to abdicate in the same gesture, I can get them to abdicate authority, right?
Yeah.
Because what these first human beings should have done is, you know, Adam should have cast Satan out, essentially. Mm-hmm. Now, I say that because when Jesus comes, he actually shows what the first Adam should have done.
Yeah.
You know, he's always casting Satan out, isn't he? He's always casting him out when he's tempted.
Yeah, right.
And essentially, in Matthew chapter 4, he's tempted in the same way.
Yeah.
Right? If you are the Son of God, or did God really say, because God had just said, you are my Son whom I loved.
Mm-hmm.
It's Genesis 3 repeated, right?
Yeah.
But Jesus gets it right. So so God has declared over Jesus, this is my Son whom I love. Satan comes along, oh, what? Did God really say that you're, if you are, then follow me and I'll, you know, it's like, I'll give you authority and I'll make you like God. And you know, it's the same temptations.
And this is part of that moving story that you talked about at the start, because I guess when we were created, in fact, when all of creation, in terms of our universe, it was already created inside this fallen world that is already in existence in terms of, you know, like the spiritual, the fallen angel, that war.
Maybe not inside it, but it's there.
Inside it physically, but in terms of the story, there was already things. It didn't start.
Yeah.
The story didn't start with us. The story had likely already was well and truly.
Again, you're thinking on a
space time. But conceptually, but conceptually, though, we were injected into something, a bigger story that was already playing out.
There's a bigger reality, even. And that, this again is that, you know, talking about these other dimensions of reality. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing then with that responsibility, because the first thing that Adam and Eve do when they, you know, when they've done the wrong thing is they hide, right? An abdication of responsibility is what you see. So God comes and he calls Adam to account. And again, in that biblical framework, there's this sense of headship. I know that's controversial, but certainly for Jewish readers, that would have made sense to them because, you know, they would have seen Adam as sort of the spiritual head in that sense. Adam blames the woman. He says, he actually says, the woman that you made.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, she made me do it, right? And then he goes to the woman, and the woman says, "The serpent that you made me do it." So it's this abdication of responsibility that ends up with Satan. But that depicts exactly what has happened. There's been an abdication of authority to Satan. So in that, they've actually flipped everything. Upside down. And so essentially, because they've joined Satan's rebellion, he becomes the prince of this world, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that they've stepped down from that by abdicating responsibility. They've stepped down from that position of authority and now they're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Now they no longer have, they still have authority, but Satan is going to, in a sense, he's taken charge and he's going to use that authority in really terrible ways. So they still have this amazing power of influence over each other and the world, but parasitically, essentially, and this is what this, because it's not just Satan, there's this world of evil, this demonic world that essentially acts as kind of parasites, spiritual parasites. They're going to be parasitic on human authority. And they're going to use human authority to bring back the chaos, because they hide in the chaos, right? Mm. That's the important. They take their shelter is in the chaos, right? This is the and you get this sense from, you know, from Revelation and you know that Babylon, the world system is described as Babylon, and it's a haunt for demons and every impure spirit, right? It's this idea that it becomes a place where evil spirits can take shelter, right? Mm. Because and who shelters them? We do. We shelter them, right? Yeah. Because we essentially give them authority. Yeah, give them authority. We give them permission, right? Yeah. By yielding to them, we give them permission. They don't. They can't just outrightly, you know, take charge of us. We have to actually yield to them. So that, I mean, that explains a lot, and that's probably another subject. Mm-hmm. But what you get then is in the curses.
Genesis
chapter 3, you get the outlining of the consequences. And this is really interesting because, you know, take something like that authority, that essentially authority becomes tyranny, right? You know, so God says to the woman, because you've done this, you know, he says, your desire will be for your husband. So you're going to be dependent. This dog-eat-dog world. Now, you're going to be dependent on him, and he's going to rule over you tyrannically. Now, it's not saying that that's a good thing or that it's a punishment, right? No. This is consequences, right? Yes. This is the consequences. So it's actually a bad thing. The idea, you know, because again, this is, you know, people say, oh, the Bible, you know, the Bible justifies the subjugation of women. Yeah. No, the Bible actually points to that as a direct result, a consequence of the fall. It's an evil, right? It's an evil that flows from it's an explanation for that. It's not a justification of that, right?
Because prior to the fall, God created them equal. You know, she was his helper alongside him from his side.
And
not
I should
to be
say,
above and not to be below.
That's right. And the word helper there, because again, you know, critics will point to, oh, so the woman's just his helper, right?
Yeah.
Do you know that where that word is most often used, it is actually of God. It's actually used of God.
Right.
Psalm 46, God is my ever-present helper. He is my helper. So it's not derogative. And it's not about rank you know, there is, because remember, I mean, and this is the countercultural. This actually was countercultural in the Bible that you don't have in the surrounding cultures, is this idea that the man and the woman together as one flesh, that they reflect the image of God. In other cultures, men reflect the image of God and women are just kind of somewhere between animals. I mean, it's terrible sorts of things that people believed. But what you have in Scripture is the basis for this fundamental equality. I mean, such a, you know, such a strong and beautiful idea of the two halves of the whole. I mean, this is another topic, but they're essentially two halves of a whole, and together they reflect the image of God, and you know, and they work together. So you get this authority becomes tyranny.
Yeah,
you know,
and the other curses, pain enters the world.
Yeah,
because go on with the curses, man. Just to keep
that's
on
right.
Track
so nature then vies against, you know, because he says by the. You know, that the land will yield thorns and thistles and of course in a, you know, in their world, you know, think about the box thorn we've got out here. I mean, I've seen fields covered with box thorn. That stuff is like demonic stuff. Have you ever been pricked with box thorn?
It's just terrible.
And it's so difficult to remove, right? Mm. And it's a plague. It just covers the fields and they are unusable, right? Mm. And so it's takes over everything. This is, you know, it's actually declaring that this disorder is going to cause certain things to happen in nature that the natural world is not going to yield for you as it was in the perfect world. It would easily yield up all of your needs, but now it's going to vie against you. Now the natural world, because you have fallen out with God, therefore you're going to fall out with each other, and you're going to fall out with the natural world. So now the natural world is going to become your enemy.
Mm-hmm. And that's because we chose to trust Satan instead of God.
Yeah, that's right. And it goes back to that. It's all relational, you know. And so, you know, aren't we now living ever, you know, we're more than ever conscious of the fact that we now are living, you know, and we're facing serious consequences of having ruined our environment. you know, the perfect balance in our, you know, atmosphere. And, you know, and I mean, this stuff rings true. This is, there's something here that I think speaks powerfully to our situation right now. So you get this, what we have after Genesis chapter 3 is this increasingly chaotic world. First, the first thing that you see in Genesis chapter 4 is the first murder. Cain kills Abel. Mm. Jealousy, mm. Right? Man, now that is, and we'll explore this in the next episode. We'll explore this much more. But what you see in the next 11 chapters is this gradual spreading of sin. It's like this plague. It's like a weed. It's like a disease that spreads throughout throughout humanity. You know, so it begins with these, and I'm, you know, I'm fine with a real Adam and Eve. I absolutely believe that it had to start somewhere with actual people, right? Because we're talking, you know, but it spreads throughout all of humanity, and you get this world. So you get people vying against people, because of course, if now we are the gods of our own world, like all of us are, like how does that work? Yeah. There's no longer one God. Mm. Now we're all little gods, and then you've got the demonic world masquerading as gods, and I mean, it's just like the
chaos turned to chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it becomes this dog eat dog world, right? And so, you know, you've got Cain kills Abel, and then you've got you've got talk of warriors celebrating how many people they've killed, and you've got interestingly, and this is a big one. That we'll explore a bit more, but Cain builds the first city. And now we think, oh, nice, a nice city. No. Cities in those days were fortresses. Mm-hmm. That's what cities were. They were walled. They were big walled fortresses. And it was
hiding.
It was essentially hiding, right? It was a way of shutting them out and keeping and defending myself against you. That's the idea of a city. Yep. And that's really civilization. The groundwork for civilization is really in these cities, you know, because then I've got to shut up my animals as well. You know what I mean? I've got to, and this is mine. And that, you know, historians talk about the development of cities as being part of, you know, defense, you know, that's tribal warfare and that grows to the point where this group of people is defending themselves against this other group of people. And so therefore I've got to have an army and I've got to feed an army. So I start
pillaging other people's,
you know,
stuff.
So I grow crops and so nutritious, you know, so like grow crops like wheat, which have almost no nutritious value, which require a lot of backbreaking work for which we weren't really built anyway. You know, I've got to shut up all my animals. So living, you know, caging up animals and living with it, that's where they, you know, readily say that's where disease, a lot of disease started. Even from a naturalistic point of view, you sort of see, and this is, I've been interested to see, like Jared Diamond, the anthropologist, historian, wrote a number of very famous books. And he says the move to the Neolithic stage in human history with cities and whatever was the greatest disaster that ever befell humankind. And it's interesting that that's kind of where you'd put the fall from a biblical point of view. You'd put the fall there. So even you've got, you know, someone like Jared Diamond recognizing that some great disaster happened back there, you know, that spawned the Neolithic the Neolithic revolution. Everything kind of goes wrong from there. Now that has really important implications for, you know, this story of progress and you know, because if the whole thing is built on that foundation, that doesn't augur well for.
And also the move from collective well-being prior to the fall to now individual, I'm looking after me, I don't care about anyone else. So that whole collective, that sense of collectiveness and our impact on all of that. And I know we'll come back to Cain and Abel in the next episode probably, but, you know, interesting to me that murder was committed over worship of God. You know,
it's like
the first murder in the Bible was actually over worship.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Isn't it interesting? And I think just to close off, and we'll continue discussing this in the next episode, but what you see is consequences. God is allowing, this is the world, this is what human beings chose, and you know, at the end of chapter 3, essentially what God is saying is that this is what you just chose. Mm. this is what I created. So you know, that second half of chapter three is a contrast to chapter one and two, where you've got this perfect world that yields and you know, it's this heavenly earth, essentially. But now you've got this situation of chaos again. We've gone back to chaos. And, you know, it's interesting that the culmination, chapter six, the culmination is growth of evil is that God sends a flood. And, of course, the flood is indicative of that original watery chaos. It's like we've gone back to Genesis 1, verse 2.
Start again.
Yeah, where we're starting again. And that's exactly what God does. He starts again. And this is where you get, you know, the story. You know, God essentially commits himself to a plan of redemption there. And that's the all important thing. So consequences are important. This is the world that we chose, and God allows those consequences to flow. But God has also committed himself to a plan of redemption. And that redemption is not God pushing man out of the way, so, oh, come on, I'll just have to fix this now. No, it's got to involve human beings because he put them in charge. And ultimately, it's got to involve one who is perfectly human, a second Adam who's going to reverse what the first Adam did. And that is why so central to everything is the name of Jesus Christ.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.